So, Rick, how did you end up initially joining up for your helicopter flight school?
Okay, it's important, I think, up front here to recognize that the United States Army and the United States Armed Forces 45 years ago were quite different than they are now. Mm-hmm. At that time, there was a draft in effect. Early 60s, for example, if a person went to college at a land-grant university, you were required to be part of ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps. So most people that graduated from high school in the early 60s really kind of expected to serve. In my case, I did quite well in high school. I graduated from high school in 1962, mm-hmm. Went to the University of Connecticut, and quite frankly spent way more time partying than I did studying. After about 2 years, I realized that I really wasn't doing quite well at all in college, and what I needed to do is find something else. So I dropped out of college. Mm-hmm. When I dropped out of college, that meant that I lost my deferment from being drafted. So I became very kind of vulnerable to be drafted, which frankly didn't particularly bother me, but I was really quite interested in choosing what I would do in the service. I had always been interested in aviation. Mm-hmm. From a youngster, I used to fly model airplanes around in circles and so forth. So I started checking in as to what opportunities there were for getting involved in flying in the service. And it turned out that the only organization that would allow a person to fly or to get into flight school without a college degree was the United States Army. The United States Army had a program at that time that allowed a guy to enlist for flight school. Mm-hmm. And actually, you could do that right out of high school. You could take a written test and a flight physical, and if you passed them, you would enlist for what the Army called the Warrant Officer Rotary Wing Aviator Course, which essentially means helicopter flight school. When you enlisted for that program, your initial enlistment term was the same two-year obligation that would be associated with being drafted.
Okay, so once you finished your flight school, 2 years service after that?
No, what happened is, so you'd enlist initially for 2 years for flight school.
Okay.
And you would go to flight school. If for some reason you didn't make it through flight school, for whatever reason, you would still be obligated to that initial 2 years that you enlisted, just like you were drafted. Mm-hmm. It took about a year to complete flight school. When that happened and you accepted your wings and your warrant officer bars, you would essentially be discharged as an enlisted person, and you would re-enlist for 3 years as a warrant officer. So the whole kind of obligation, assuming you made it through flight school, was about 4 years long. Mm-hmm. While you were in flight school, you had the rank of a sergeant, and you received flight pay, and then, of course, you received your warrant officer bars and wings when you graduate from flight school. Just about everybody that graduated from flight school went to Vietnam. Either went to Vietnam and joined a unit already in Vietnam, an aviation unit as a replacement, or you joined a unit that was about ready to be sent to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I joined the 1st Cavalry Division. It's an air mobile division. It was the Army's first air mobile division. And I joined A Company of the 229th Assault Helicopter Battalion, 1st Cavalry Division. The 1st Cavalry Division was really kind of set up for the situation in Vietnam. It was the Army's first air mobile division. And what that essentially means is that they used helicopters and air mobile assault tactics to rapidly move light infantry around the battlefield and then used helicopters again for all the logistics necessary to maintain the field operation. A lot of the 1st Cavalry Division soldiers, infantry, were airborne. And actually, there was one, the 1st Brigade of the 1st Cavalry Division, which would include three battalions, were all airborne. The entire brigade was airborne. So you can almost think of using the helicopters kind of somewhat similar to the way paratroopers were used in World War II. But instead of the guys jumping out of airplanes, the helicopters would bring them into a landing zone. Mm-hmm. Super professional outfit. I was really quite impressed with the United States Army during my service in Vietnam, and quite unimpressed with the United States Army at my second duty station, which was in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, were you working quite close with, like, the sort of ground troops that you were dropping off and, you know, transporting around and stuff during training and then into Vietnam?
Maybe I could describe the way a combat assault worked.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, your combat assault would essentially be moving an infantry unit into a landing zone out in the field. And the typical combat assault involved moving a company-sized unit of infantry. And there were more than 400 helicopters assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division. So the 1st Cavalry Division could move a large number of infantry in one lift if need be. And that happened on occasion. We had air mobile assaults. For example, one that comes to mind had to do with Quezon, where the initial assault involved moving a whole battalion of infantry with like 50 helicopters.
Okay.
But that was really quite unusual. A much more usual combat assault involved moving a company-sized unit of infantry using five troop-carrying helicopters, like the ones I flew. And those troop-carrying helicopters, the formation of five, would be escorted by two helicopter gunships that were designed to shoot rockets and machine guns at the ground. And the way it worked would be that a landing zone would be chosen. We didn't get involved in that at our level. But a landing zone would be chosen in the field, and a arrival time of the helicopters into the landing zone would be negotiated between the flight leader and the operations officer of the infantry unit.
Mm-hmm.
And on what we would call a full prep combat assault, which would be an assault where the landing zone was struck with 1st Cav artillery before the helicopters brought the first lift of infantry into the landing zone. What would happen is an arrival time in the landing zone would be negotiated. 1st Cav artillery would shoot into the landing area while the formation of helicopters was en route with the first lift of infantry. And we would typically use five troop-carrying helicopters. Each of those helicopters would have seven infantry on board. So you'd essentially put 35 guys into the landing zone with each lift. 35 guys was a platoon. While you were en route to the landing zone, there'd be artillery being fired into the landing zone, really for two reasons. The obvious one being the potential for the enemy to be present. Mm-hmm. In the landing zone area. But we were also concerned about booby traps, particularly back in the hills where most of the full prep assaults took place, and the artillery into the landing zone would have a tendency to set off any booby traps that were there. This was really a closely coordinated operation.
Yeah.
The last round fired by the artillery battery would be white phosphorus. And that white phosphorus round would be timed so that it would arrive in the landing zone when the formation was 1 minute out. Our company commander led many of the assaults, I'm in contact with him often by email now. He tells me that he was unhappy with himself if he missed the agreed-to arrival time in the landing zone by more than plus or minus 5 seconds. So it was really quite well timed. So we would bring that first group of 35 infantry into the landing zone. We would spend very little time actually on the ground in the landing zone, maybe 10, 15 seconds at the most. The infantry would bail out. We would leave. And the first 35 guys into the landing zone, their initial job was to secure the landing zone while we returned to the pickup zone where we had loaded them initially, and then we would bring the rest of the company into the same landing zone using two or three additional lifts, maybe, depending on how up to full strength the unit was. These are very short flights. The 1st Cavalry Division did its level best to make sure that the infantry were always within the boundary of 1st Cav Artillery.
Okay.
Yeah. So they didn't want them to be out beyond 1st Cav Artillery coverage. And the maximum range of the 105mm cannons that they used was only like 7 miles.
Okay, so what, these landing zones were never more than 7 miles away from... Or never much more than 7 miles away from...
Most of the flights that we were on would be short. I mean, it'd be like 10 minutes long. As a matter of fact, a good example of that is to look at my personal flight records. And I logged my first flight time in Vietnam on May 11th, 1967. So the rest of May and the month of June, which is a 50-day period, I logged 229 hours of flight time, and the Hueys that I flew in logged an absolutely amazing 1,122 landings. So if you average that out, you're looking at like 4.5 hours of flight time per day and 4 to 5 landings per hour. So they're really short flights. If you spoke to a person in the Air Force, they would call that flying down in the weeds all the time, and really quite close to the ground.
Yeah.
So that was a major mission of our assault helicopter company, where there was combat assaults. And then we would also go out into the field at the end of a unit's operation and bring them back to their base camp. So that would be extracting them from the field. And then the third kind of major mission that we had would be resupplying them in the field. We called it, sometimes call it flying ash and trash. The infantry would often refer to the helicopter as the log bird. And what you were essentially doing is bringing them everything they needed. So that was normally a single aircraft mission. And you'd have one of our Hueys assigned to a battalion in the field. They would spend the entire day just flying back and forth from the field to the logistics pad for the infantry unit, and you'd spend the whole day just hauling them what they needed: food, water, ammunition, replacements, that sort of thing.
Okay. And they would be the short 10-minute flights, never getting very far above the ground, constantly like...
Well, you would try to get at least 2,000 feet above the ground en route. And the reason for that was you were pretty safe from small arms fire if you were above 2,000 feet. If the weather was such that you couldn't get that high, the last thing you really wanted to do was fly around at maybe 500-600 feet above the ground, because it made you vulnerable to ground fire. So if you couldn't get 2,000 feet or so, we would stay right on the deck.
Okay.
And you'd fly out low level. And because you were low level, you'd be over and beyond somebody before they could really get their weapon up. And if you have a helicopter coming towards you, and you can't see it, it's really quite difficult to tell exactly where it's coming from just based on the noise. So you were usually over and beyond someone before they could really shoot at you.
I imagine this was mostly over like quite sort of dense like jungle and stuff as well. So
one of the real benefits from my standpoint of flying for the 1st Cavalry Division is that because the entire field operation of the division was oriented around the use of helicopters, everybody became very familiar with the capabilities of the aircraft and the capabilities of the pilots. And you quite frankly, it never had someone ask you to do something that was just flat stupid. I mean, they were reasonable requests that you could usually handle, and they really worked on that. For example, we would often have an officer that was going to spend time in the rear in operations or in personnel or in intelligence or whatever. But if that person was a rated helicopter pilot, when they arrived in Vietnam, they would usually be assigned to one of the assault helicopter companies for maybe a week or 10 days, and they would fly the same missions we flew. So you would often have a warrant officer, aircraft commander, and you might have a major as your co-pilot.
Yeah.
And that person was going to work 2 weeks from now. He'd be back in the rear. But they got an opportunity to experience the same flying that we did out in the field. And as a result, people didn't ask you to do kind of stupid things. It really worked quite well.
Yeah. Did you find that the training that you did at flight school was, like, prepared you well for the sort of flying you was doing out there?
The training was just flat excellent. And it came in kind of two phases. When you completed your basic training, you went to a place called Fort Walters, Texas, and that's where you joined a flight school class and received your primary helicopter training. The first month was ground school and just pure harassment on the part of the tactical officers and so forth. And what they were essentially trying to do is to get you to quit before you had a bunch of time and effort expended on actual flying. So the first month was just kind of a cram course in OCS and pure harassment. And then you learn to fly the basic operation of flying a helicopter on small observation-type helicopters, two-place, three-place helicopters. And that's what you spent your time doing at Fort Walters. At the end of your primary helicopter training at Fort Walters, you would take a primary check ride to essentially demonstrate that you were able to perform the maneuvers and so forth that you were supposed to learn in primary flight school. When you passed that, you would travel to Fort Rucker, Alabama with your flight school class, and there you transitioned into the Huey that most of us would fly in Vietnam. We received instrument flight training, and we received tactical training in formation flying, formation assaults, our landings to landing zones, night flying, low-level navigation, that sort of thing. The instructors at Fort Rucker were just outstanding. Most of them were combat veterans that had served a tour in Vietnam already. They knew what you would be exposed to when you went to Vietnam, and just very excellent training. And once you arrived at your unit in Vietnam, you would fly as a co-pilot until you received aircraft commander orders. The aircraft commanders in the company basically served as combat instructor pilots for the new guys that were arriving from flight school. And very excellent training. We had a situation in our company, I don't know if all of them were like this, but you would fly with many, many different aircraft commanders. You would essentially learn who you were going to fly with when you went to the operations bunker in the morning and looked at the mission assignment sheet. And you would find your name. Your name would be on a crew assigned to a particular helicopter, And you would know then who the aircraft commander you were going to fly with that day and who would be the gunner and the crew chief and so forth. And of course, the good part about that is that the new pilots had an opportunity to fly with basically all the aircraft commanders in the company, and you had instruction from many different people. Very excellent training.
Okay. So the combat assault flights that you were doing in Vietnam, do you get the sense that they were making a difference, that they were achieving the sort of objectives that they'd been set out to achieve?
From our standpoint at the company level, we didn't know a heck of a lot about what the overall operational purposes were for a particular part of the mission. As an example, the last combat flying that I flew in Vietnam had to do with the Khe Sanh combat base. Mm-hmm. And they call it the relief of Khe Sanh, but it really had to do with a joint operation between the 1st Cavalry Division and the Marines. And we flew those missions. I've learned since then what the operational purposes were for what we were doing and so forth, and I can reflect back on the combat assaults we made and so forth and realize why we were doing them. But at the time, you really didn't have any of that information. You knew what your job was going to be because of where you were located in the formation. You were so focused on flying the aircraft properly and not making a mistake that got somebody hurt and so forth, that you were really concentrated on just doing your job as a pilot, as opposed to worrying about exactly why you were doing something.
Yeah, so you had quite you're quite well informed at the sort of like tactical level.
Yeah, at the tactical level, I mean, I knew what I was supposed to do, that's for sure. Now, we had other missions in addition to combat assaults and extractions and flying the logistics. Those three items was where the majority of our flight time took place. Mm-hmm. But we had some other missions we would fly. One would be emergency resupplies at night, where a 1st Cav ground unit was either in contact with the enemy or had recently been in contact with the enemy, and the commander on the ground decided he wanted to be resupplied with ammunition before daylight. There's really a huge amount of trust associated with that, because flying at night in Vietnam was quite dangerous, particularly if there was an overcast sky. It became very difficult to kind of see what you were doing, item one. Item two, when we got out to the landing zone, we would shoot the approach with absolutely no lights. The reason for that was that you just simply did not want to turn your landing light on when you were low and slow and there were enemy in the area. So we would shoot a lights-out approach. Really quite dangerous flying. But we knew that the infantry on the ground would not ask us to fly at night unless there really was an emergency involved.
Yeah.
The guys on the ground knew that barring some sort of really extraordinarily poor weather, that if they asked for our help, we would come. So there's a huge amount of trust between the aviation units and the guys on the ground, and I guess I can honestly say that I have not experienced that degree of trust between people that did not personally know each other since I left Vietnam. That's all there is to it. And they talk about the comradeship of arms and so forth, that might be an example of it. Mm-hmm. So that was one mission we flew. We also flew another mission that was really challenging to fly and frankly quite fun to fly, when we were insert long-range reconnaissance patrols into the field. Long-range reconnaissance patrol is a small group of soldiers, 3 to maybe 5, and their mission is to gather intelligence out in the field. They were by themselves. They would sometimes also call in airstrikes or artillery if they noticed a collection of enemy in an area. And the trick was when you were inserting them in the field to get them on the ground without the enemy realizing that happened. The tactics we used to do that were really kind of interesting. There'd be a troop-carrying helicopter assigned to the long-range reconnaissance patrol company, and you might spend a week or two with them. The day before the insertion of the team, you would go out, and the aircraft commander would be in charge of all this, but you'd go out with the team leader from the long-range reconnaissance patrol, and the two of you would choose the landing zone that you were going to use in the field. And you, the ideal landing zone would be pretty good size, but not so large that you'd be real concerned about it being booby-trapped. And the ideal landing zone will also have some upland terrain around it. On the day you were going to insert the LRP team, you would go out with two other troop-carrying aircraft and two helicopter gunships. So you'd have three troop-carrying helicopters, two gunships. The gunships would stay up high. The three troop-carrying aircrafts would get right on the deck in a loose trail formation with the helicopters maybe, 75 yards apart, something like that. And the LRP team would be in the lead helicopter. And the aircraft commander in that lead helicopter would be flying. Very difficult low-level navigation challenge because you would get down on the deck miles away from the landing zone. And you would kind of wander around right on the deck with those three helicopters in a trail formation. And it was really important to put the LRP team in the exact landing zone that they expected to be, because when they got out of the helicopter, they were on their own, and they had to start knowing where in the heck they were, obviously. So as you came up on the landing zone, the lead aircraft would make a big flare, and we'd come to a hover in the landing zone. We wouldn't set down in the landing zone. And the reason for that is you wanted to maintain power on the rotor system so the sound of the helicopter didn't change. So you would come to a hover in the landing zone, and the LRP team would bail out, and there's a plexiglass top on the top front of a Huey that you can look up at the sky. The two helicopters behind you in the formation would fly right over top of you. So you'd be sitting at a hover there, and when you looked up and saw the nose of the second Huey, you'd make a maximum performance takeoff and get up in the end of that line. In a way, that worked as if there was the enemy was a quarter of a mile away, and they were watching these three Hueys, they'd see three Hueys go behind a hill, and three Hueys come out the other side of the hill, but the first aircraft would now be in the rear and the LRP team would be on the ground. And that was a really satisfying mission to accomplish properly. And what you would do after that insertion is that you'd go back to the infantry unit's base camp and wait, because the first hour or so after the LRP team was inserted was really important, because you wanted to make sure that the enemy didn't know they were there. If the LRP team was discovered, you'd have to go in and take them out.
Okay. So if they were discovered, you'd have to go straight back and take them out, but did you go back and it was always the same people to go and collect them afterwards, or did they just work the way back?
Well, depending on how long that they were going to spend in the field. Sometimes they would spend 3 days, sometimes longer, and it would depend on whether or not your assignment to support the LRP company was over with or not. It's quite conceivable that a different helicopter crew would extract them from the field. But the extraction, when it took place in a routine manner, wasn't usually a big deal. The extractions when the team was located by the enemy, it was essentially an emergency extraction, those could be very dangerous because there was only five guys on the ground, and there were a lot of the awards for heroism that were provided to helicopter pilots were associated with things like that, an emergency extraction of a unit under fire, for example. Okay. I never had to do that. I flew a number of insertions. I never flew an emergency extraction. Okay. The system worked, apparently.
Not many of these. Was there that many emergency extractions?
I don't think there were all that many of them discovered. And actually, I guess one comment I would make about that in general is that the popular literature about the Vietnam War has many more hot LZs in it than actually took place. Mm-hmm. The tactics that I mentioned earlier work quite well. As a matter of fact, some of the questions I received about it is, well, you know, you're letting these guys know you're coming with an artillery prep that lasts 5 minutes or so before the helicopters show up, so when you get into the landing zone, they're not there anymore. And actually, if you're riding in the helicopters as part of the crew of the infantry, that's not really a bad thing. That's all there is to it. And also, the landing zones that were hot, and there were few of them for me. There were some, but not many. One of the questions is, you know, you're dropping 35 guys off in the boondocks. Isn't that a problem if the enemy is in the area? And it's important to understand that above the landing zone would be a command and control helicopter. It was usually a Huey, not taking part in the assault itself, but in that aircraft would be the infantry unit's operations officer and the infantry unit's commander and an artillery liaison officer. So the ground commander in that first group of 35 guys could have artillery called in to support him almost instantly.
Did you fly all these various roles of like the troop,
no,
helicopters, the gunships?
I did not fly at all the role of the command and control. Yeah. That was a different part of the 1st Cavalry Division. Mm-hmm. I flew the other missions, though, all the other missions. Another mission we flew at night was called a lightning bug mission, sometimes called a firefly mission. That involved, again, this is an excellent example of the coordination that takes place. That involved one troop-carrying helicopter, two helicopter gunships, and a fixed-wing aircraft called an OV-1 Mohawk. The fixed-wing aircraft was really a high-performance turbine aircraft, and that fixed-wing aircraft had a sensor on it called side-looking airborne radar. You gotta realize now we're talking 45 years ago. Mm-hmm. I suspect it was quite classified then, but that fixed-wing aircraft could pass six-digit coordinates to the aircraft commander in the troop-carrying aircraft of anything moving on the ground. So you'd go out at night, the aircraft commander in the troop-carrying aircraft was in charge of the whole operation, and if you had coordinates passed to you from the Mohawk with respect to something on the ground, you'd go over in that area, you had two items in the aircraft that you could use to illuminate the area. One were flares. They were about 6 feet long, very high candle power. I don't know exactly what it was, a million candle power at least. It would light up a really large area. Yeah. You also had in the cargo compartment of the helicopter a cluster of C-130 landing lights, like five, six of them, that the crew chief could aim. And what you were supposed to do is essentially illuminate what was moving on the ground, and then the aircraft commander and the troop-carrying aircraft had the capability to authorize the gunships to attack it, or you could call in artillery also. I flew those missions also. Once you were assigned the role of an aircraft commander, you were pretty much checked out to fly the various missions we flew at the company level. We also did non-combat flying that might involve something like moving a USO troop from one area to another, from one secure area to another, those sorts of things.
They would be quite high, like altitude ones, as opposed to sort of hugging the ground thing.
Yeah, you would take off from a secure area, very quickly climb to 3,000 feet or whatever, fly to where you were going, and then come down. We had an interesting approach we flew that was, again, flat fun to do. When we thought we might receive ground fire from a landing zone, and sometimes you knew that because the first time you went into the landing zone, someone shot at you, or the guys on the ground just simply told you there's enemy in the area and you can expect ground fire. The approach was called a high overhead approach, which was really fun to fly. You would get right over the landing zone at above small arms fire concern, maybe 3,000 feet, say. And what the whole objective was to get from 3,000 feet or wherever your altitude was on the ground as quickly as possible, and you were also trying to stay right over the landing zone that you knew was secure. So you'd get right over the landing zone, you would completely unload the power from the rotor system.
So is that like shut it off? Like,
well, except you still had the engine turned on, but the engine was supplying zero power to the rotor system. So it was essentially a power on auto rotation.
Mm-hmm.
You get into a very, very tight turn, and you would kick the aircraft out of trim. So both having the power off, being in a tight turn and out of trim would make you come down quickly. And you would literally come down quickly. And you had to time the approach so that when you came out of the last turn, you'd be on short final to the landing zone, and you'd have to get the nose up and the power back on and trimmed up again, and then you'd land in the landing zone. And that really scared people. We were hauling as cargo when the first time it happened, but it was really the safest way to get from altitude onto the ground if the enemy was in the area. And then when you left, you would stay right on the deck. So you'd leave the landing zone and you'd stay right at low level until you were going about 100 miles an hour or so. And then you'd make what was called a cyclic climb. So you'd transmit your 100 mile an hour forward velocity into a vertical velocity and kind of zoom up to a couple 3,000 feet again.
Is that the sort of stuff that they like, you know, when you watch all these old Vietnam War films, are they the sort of like stunts that they like showing off in these films? Is that the sort of stuff that I'm imagining in my head? Is that what I'm seeing in these films?
Well, I guess one of the things you have to realize is that the pilots are mostly very young.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest pilot killed in Vietnam was a warrant officer pilot who was 2 or 3 days shy of 19 years, 2 months old when he was shot down. And the reason the warrant officer pilots were so young had to do with the fact that you could enlist for flight school right out of high school. So that's a guy that probably enlisted for flight school literally right out of high school, went through flight school, and shortly after he arrived in Vietnam, he was shot down. So basically you have a lot of very young warrant officers that flat think what they're doing is fun. I mean, we literally thought it was fun.
Yeah. So you would say you enjoyed your Vietnam experience, huh? I guess.
One of the comments I would make, I guess, about the tactics is that those air mobile assault tactics that I talked about earlier, I would say worked quite well when your opponents were light infantry armed with 30 caliber weapons, AK-47s, that sort of weapon. Once you start talking about larger weapons, 50 caliber or anti-aircraft artillery or surface-to-air missiles, I don't think the tactics would work. Because somebody with a dual 50 caliber machine gun could literally tear up a formation of Hueys. That's all there is to it. And I suspect that the sort of air mobile assault that I described earlier probably won't happen again, just because the enemy has more effective anti-aircraft weapons than existed in the North Vietnamese Army for the most part in South Vietnam. So the heliborne assaults that would take place now, I suspect that's why they're at night. And they're normally using a helicopter that carries more individuals than a Huey. Even a Black Hawk will carry more infantry than a Huey would. But I think it's primarily associated with the fact that the special operations assaults that are going on now are happening at night. The pilots are wearing night vision goggles, and they can see what they're doing, but the enemy can't see the helicopters to shoot at them.
Mm-hmm. You were aware at the time or not that the Hueys were quite vulnerable to this, like, 50 cal plus?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, certainly one bullet in the right place will bring down a Huey. By the same token, the biggest portion of the aircraft is essentially air inside two pieces of sheet metal. So you can take a lot of hits and have no problems whatsoever. You can also take one hit and go down. Most of the flying we did was in conjunction with other helicopters. So if, in fact, you did go down, and I had this happen to me, there were people there very, very quickly to pick you up. One day when we were flying, we lost a tail rope. As a matter of fact, we were flying for a long-range reconnaissance patrol when that happened. We had two of the long-range reconnaissance patrol people on board the aircraft and four crew members, and we lost the tail rope. Tail rope just flew off the helicopter. We ended up crashing on a beach. I was flying as the co-pilot at that time, so the aircraft commander flew the aircraft, and what I did was let everybody in the world know, one, that we were going down, and two, exactly where we were going to be on the ground. And one of the things that really interesting that happened is the commanding general of the 1st Cavalry Division, so he would have been a two-star general, his name was Tolson. He was a rated helicopter pilot. He happened to be flying and monitored the emergency radio call I made, or one of them. So we crashed, and in a matter of minutes, a helicopter landed. The helicopter was being flown by the commanding general of the 1st Cavalry Division, which I always thought that was kind of cool, to tell you the honest truth. And I suspect he received an award for that, and he probably deserved it. And shortly after he arrived, another group of helicopters arrived that had infantry on board, landed around our crashed Huey, set up a perimeter, and a medevac came in and hauled out the guys that were injured.
Was that consistent throughout your experience there, that if it, like, downed helicopter, they'd pick him up, like, instantly, more or less?
Well, that was certainly the case with the 1st Cavalry Division. Yeah. Now, how that worked with other helicopter units, I really can't comment on. Yeah. But it sure worked well with the 1st Cavalry Division.
Because a lot of the American POWs were pilots and stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, except a lot of the pilots that were POWs, rather than being helicopter pilots, were Navy or Air Force fighter pilots.
Yeah.
The vast majority of them were shot down over North Vietnam. Although I know of a situation where a 1st Cavalry Division Huey crashed at night in poor weather, and one of the individuals captured was taken all the way to North Vietnam and ended up spending 6 years as a POW. He was a flight surgeon for one of the aviation units in the 1st Cavalry Division.
Okay, so it was mainly, there were exceptions obviously, but it was mainly like fixed wing pilots and stuff. So I probably should have asked this at the beginning, actually, but where were you actually stationed? Or was it multiple places? Or?
Okay, about the first three quarters of my tour, I was stationed at a place called Elsie Inlet, and that was a base camp that was located in the northeast corner of Tukor on the coastal plain. Mm-hmm. Located in what's called the Bong Song Plain. And then shortly before 68 Tet, so in January of 68, we, along with about two-thirds of the 1st Cavalry Division, moved from that area in Tukor up to south of the demilitarized zone, north of Wei. And, of course, they moved us up there for, they must have had inklings that 68 Tet was going to take place. We knew nothing about that at our level. So the last 4 months or so of my tour in Vietnam were in I Corps. We were there at a place called Elsie Evans. Elsie Evans was located north of the city of Wei, and south of Quang Tri. We had most of our operations were in the coastal plain, right next to the coast, mm-hmm. until something called Operation Pegasus, which was the 1st Cavalry Division involvement with the Marines in Quezon. At the completion of Operation Pegasus is when I stopped my combat flying. We're kind of subject to being injured at those landing zones also. They were base camps, and they were reasonably secure, but they were also mortared on occasion. When you moved into a new area, what you would try to do very quickly is construct for yourself a relatively safe place to sleep. So there was a lot of sandbag filling going on and so forth. And when we moved up to I Corps, I ended up building a bunker basically off the back of my tent, and that's what I slept in. So that bunker was set up so that I could probably take a direct hit with a mortar round. It might wake me up, but that would be about it.
Okay. So the outposts were fairly secure.
Well, these were pretty good sized areas, though. I mean, the land, Elsie Inlet, was hundreds of acres in size, and it was the home base for aviation units, artillery units, infantry units, support units. It had its own fixed-wing landing strip that could easily accommodate a four-engine C-130 Air Force cargo plane. Big area. A lot of the outlying fire bases and so forth, of course, were much smaller than that.
What was the sort of structure? It was like Elsie Inlet was like one of the main ones then, I guess. And then it goes out to these firing posts, and they gradually just sort of decrease in size.
Elsie Inlet was a major base camp, had artillery units and so forth. The main base for the 1st Cavalry Division in Tukor was at An Khe, which is in the central highlands to the west of Elsie Inlet. But Elsie Inlet was kind of the 1st Cavalry Division headquarters east, and it was a big area.
So is when you were flying your operations, you flew from LZ English, or did you fly from small places?
Our company area was at LZ English, so that's where we had all our helicopters and revetments to protect them from mortar attack and so forth. That's where our company headquarters were. That's where our tents were located in our mess area and so forth. So that was our home. And what we would do in the morning is go into the operations bunker there at LZ English, find out what you'd be doing the rest of the day. And if you were hauling logistics, for example, you would usually start at the infantry unit's base camp that might be at LZ English on another part of LZ English, might be someplace else too, but then you'd spend the day flying back and forth, but you would return at the end of the day to LZ English again. That's where your bunk would be.
So the assault missions that you're flying, when you said they was all within 7 miles, it was...
Well, the assaults would be within 7 miles of a fire base usually, but you might have a fire base 15 miles out into the field, and then you might make assaults 5-6 miles beyond that yet.
Okay. So, I guess you didn't know it at the time, but those like assault missions were part of the whole search and destroy thing. They'd go in and try and exterminate the enemy and then come back out again.
That's probably another difference we should talk about. In this, this isn't really based on personal experience, but I would essentially say there were, for the most part, two different wars going on simultaneously at the beginning of the war. The 1st Cavalry Division spent most of its time operating against North Vietnamese Army regular Army units. So these guys were in uniforms, they were well-armed, they were well-led, and it's essentially one group of trained military soldiers operating against another. That's quite different than the sort of war that was taking place much farther south in Vietnam, in the Delta area, where there were more insurgents, Viet Minh, Viet Cong units that had a tendency to be nowhere near as well armed and also operated more as guerrilla forces. So they were in peasant uniforms and so forth. Guys that we were operating against were wearing military uniforms just like we were, for the most part.
Could you actually see that from like your position on the battlefield? Could you see that
they
were fairly organized?
You mean the enemy?
Yeah.
The only time I ever saw a member of the enemy in the field was one day when I managed to get lost, which is not a good thing to have happen to you when you're supposed to be in command of the helicopter. Of course, we didn't have GPS and that sort of thing. We navigated using the same topographic maps that were carried by the infantry. But one day I got lost, and I decided that what I needed to do was figure out where I was real quickly. So I headed east, looking for just a ground feature that I remembered. And if not, I would eventually hit the coast and I could figure out where I was once I hit the coast. But while we were flying along, I literally saw a member of the enemy in a khaki uniform and with an AK-47. And he heard us coming, I think, before he saw us, because when I actually observed the person, he was doing his level best to get under a bush while we went by. But there's no question. That's the only time I can remember actually seeing an enemy in the field. I did bring some members of the enemy back that were captured in the field, so we would transport them back to the base camp.
Was getting lost like a common occurrence amongst helicopter pilots?
It wasn't supposed to be a common occurrence. You know, the joke is that Army aviators are never lost. Sometimes they're temporarily disoriented, but they're never lost. I was flat lost. That's all I was doing. That's the only time I can remember that happening personally, because you really had to know where you were all the time.
Yeah. So it was, Was you flying on your own in that instance?
Well, no, I had I was in a Huey with three other crew members.
Well, I mean, as a single helicopter.
Oh yes, it was a single helicopter. We were flying our logistics mission.
Okay. So they would be in those logistics missions quite often, going to quite remote locations.
Yeah, I'd say it was really unusual for someone to get lost.
Even though that these logistics missions were quite regular and going to places that were probably quite hard to find, I would assume.
Yeah, because actually you normally operate in the operational area that you were reasonably familiar with. Where it was real or much easier, I'd say, to get lost was when you're flying at night, obviously. But there we normally didn't have too much of a problem, because what we would do is go from the base camp to a particular landing zone, drop off the ammunition for the emergency resupply, and then come right back to the same base camp. We had an FM homing device in the helicopter that gave us a course indication whenever the guys on the ground transmitted on their backpack FM radio. So, and you'd be talking to them on the way out there, because they would tell you what the nature of the landing zone was, where the obstructions were, what the situation was with the enemy, and so forth. And while you were talking back and forth, every time they transmitted, you'd get a course indication on the instrument panel. So finding the landing zones wasn't all that big a deal, usually.
Okay, and you knew the area reasonably well.
Yeah.
Okay. So the night missions, they would use the FM radio almost solely on their own. I imagine maps probably weren't.
Well, oftentimes when you flew at night, you would fly out as a single ship carrying the ammunition, but because the unit was in contact or had recently been in contact, there were often helicopter gunships out there around the landing zone that were supporting the guys on the ground.
So that was like a good visual sort of cue.
Well, it wasn't too much of a visual clue, because you didn't want to light yourself up. You would make yourself a target. So we would find the landing zone based more on getting the course indications from the homing device than anything else. And you'd be talking to the gunships, too, so they knew you were coming and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I think you've got a lot of my questions answered, Rick.
Okay, I sure hope that helps you, Josh.
Did you say that the Operation Pegasus was after the Tet Offensive?
Well, on my tour of duty kind of bracketed the Tet Offensive. So I arrived in May of 67, I left in May of 68, and the 68 Tet Offensive took place the end of January 68.
Okay. Was there like a noticeable difference in the sort of atmosphere of your like operations that like as the time went on? If you know what I mean.
I guess I noticed a difference in myself, is your question? I'm sure. I guess I matured. I became more confident in my ability to fly the helicopter. I became more knowledgeable about the way the operations worked and so forth. I really quite enjoyed flying with new pilots out of flight school and trying to help them get their feet on the ground and so forth. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about an aviation unit, of course, different from the infantry, is that it really took all four crew members on a Huey to operate it properly. And you had to work together as a team. You had to depend upon each other. The door gunners would help us clear turns. The crew chief, for example, if we were going into a small landing zone, some of the landing zones in the jungle weren't a heck of a lot larger than the helicopter. They would be trees that would be cut down with train saws or blown up with plastic explosive, but the landing zone itself was very small. When we would make an approach into an area like that, the crew chief flew the left door gun. They would watch the tail rotor. So while you were making your approach into the landing zone, the crew chief had his eyes on the tail rotor, and if the pilots got the tail rotor anywhere near close to an obstruction, they'd find out about it. That's all there was to it. And you trusted what the crew chief was saying. If he said you need to move the tail rotor starboard 5 feet, you moved it 5 feet. You didn't talk about it, you just did it. So there really was a sense of teamwork on the helicopter. No one got into the situation where they didn't tell somebody something to be cool about it or whatever.
Yeah.
Another question I get asked quite often has to do with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And the drug situation in Vietnam. It may be partially associated with the fact that I did absolutely no drugs whatsoever before I arrived, so I may have been kind of a naive person to start with. I don't know. But we're also early in the war, but to my knowledge, there was no one in our unit fooling with drugs. We drank a heck of a bunch of beer, and I can certainly remember flying with a hangover, that sort of thing, which probably isn't much different, I suppose, but there was no one fooling with drugs that I'm aware of.
Is that something that's got blown out of proportion then, in your opinion?
And there's no one would really put up with that either. Someone got on the aircraft stoned, a door gunner, for example, and the aircraft commander knew about that, he wouldn't let him on the aircraft because you simply depended upon the other person and you just wouldn't put up with it.
What would be the sort of consequences for someone who did try and pull something like that? Would he just be...
I don't know, to tell you the truth, because it never happened.
Yeah, okay.
Although there were times that what they would do is, for example, when we were at LZ English, someone would have intelligence that LZ English was going to be mortared. So they decide that, well, all we need to do is move the helicopters for the night, which we thought was a great deal because what we would do is then fly from LZ English to Quy Nhon, about 50 miles south. Quy Nhon had a regular officers' club and flush toilets and all kinds of neat stuff. And we would do some significant drinking in the officers' club in Quy Nhon. In the morning when we flew back to LZ English, some of us would have a hangover, there's no doubt about it. But that's about as bad as it would get.
Okay. So what exactly is the command structure in the helicopter then? So you've got the aircraft commander, who is the pilot, I guess.
Well, a lot of times they'll say there's a pilot and a co-pilot.
Yeah.
What we would say is there's an aircraft commander and a pilot. The aircraft commander was the person that was responsible for the operation of the helicopter no matter who was flying. So if there was a helicopter crash, for example, people would talk to the aircraft commander. It really didn't matter if the other guy was flying when the helicopter crashed. The responsibility rested with the aircraft commander. And that aircraft commander designation was not based on rank. It was based on demonstrated ability to fly the aircraft and also the experience necessary to accomplish all the missions you were assigned, and also having demonstrated that you had the presence of mind and the coolness and so forth to do all that. So it was quite often that an aircraft commander would be a warrant officer one, which is the lowest grade of officer in the United States Army. The co-pilot might be a major, or the pilot might be a major. So you have an aircraft commander as a warrant officer, a pilot as a major. Once the skids of the aircraft left the ground, the person in charge was the warrant officer. Everybody knew who the aircraft commander was before the aircraft left the ground.
So there's no, say if it was a major, there was no ego getting in the way or anything like that?
No. if a decision needed to be made with respect to the operation of the aircraft, the person that made it was the aircraft commander, no matter what their rank was.
Okay. And that worked well?
Yes, it sure did. Everybody knew the way the system mm-hmm. worked, and at least I never had a problem in that regard whatsoever.
So there was the aircraft commander and the pilot and the two gunners.
Right. One of the person that served as a gunner was the crew chief. He flew the left door gun. The crew chief was a trained mechanic. So in addition to serving as a door gunner, he was also responsible for the daily maintenance on the aircraft when we finished flying. He also had other duties, one of which we spoke about a little bit earlier, watching the tail rotor when you were in a tight LZ. The crew chief also monitored how much weight was being placed on board when we were hauling cargo. And we could haul about a ton in addition to the crew and the door guns and the ammunition and the fuel. Now, once it got close to a ton, the crew chief would tell the guys on the enlisted, on the logistics pad, that's all we're going to take. And that got to be really quite important because sometimes we would pick up a load of cargo at LZ English, which is pretty much at sea level, and we might take that cargo to a hilltop back in the hills that might be, 2,000 meters or so. And at that higher altitude, the helicopter really had less ability to hover. It had less power than it did at sea level. So it was really important to kind of monitor how much weight you were.
Was that noticeable as a pilot?
Could you feel it? Yeah, it sure was. Sometimes we take off with a full load of fuel and a full load of infantry on an assault, and we'd be making that assault to a pinnacle on a hilltop. And you would—you might not even have enough power to hover. You might have to shoot your approach right to the ground. So until the 7th Infantry got off, and once that happened, of course, you had much less weight you could take off without any problem. Yeah, you had to be careful about that.
Was talking about getting down, shot down before or whatever. Was there many instances of people, the aircraft being overloaded or? Overstretched. Well, not overstretched, overloaded. And
what would happen is if the aircraft was overloaded, you were running out of power, you would know that because you would try to come to a hover and you wouldn't have enough power to hover, and the engine RPM would start to bleed off and the rotor RPM would start to bleed off. And what would happen then is the crew chief would tell the infantry you need to get off right now. So sometimes you would have to have the infantry jump out of the aircraft 4 or 5 feet off the ground just to make sure you maintained enough power.
Okay.
It didn't happen all that often, though. One of the things that happened with the 1st Cavalry Division about halfway through my tour is we received brand new Huey helicopters that had a more powerful engine. So the aircraft that we received about halfway through my tour had 1,400 horsepower. The ones we were using prior to that, if you looked at the helicopter, you'd think it was exactly the same helicopter, but it had a less powerful engine. It only had about 1,100 horsepower. That extra 300 horsepower made quite a difference when you were making an approach to a pinnacle back in the hills.
Was there any difference after the transition to a better engine, in the sort of what they might expect you to, the way they might expect you to fly and stuff like that?
We flew exactly the same missions. The aircraft flew exactly the same. It's just that you had a power reserve of 300 horsepower that you didn't have prior to that. So it made the operation safer, is what it amounts to.
But they didn't change the operations.
No, the missions we flew and so forth didn't change at all. We carried the same number of troops. There was no change. Another difference that happened with the 1st Cavalry Division, and I suspect it's because we had so many helicopters, and it's also because the whole operation was built around the helicopter. On our typical combat assaults, the infantry that we would bring into the landing zone would have their personal weapon, ammunition, water, first aid gear, and that's it. They didn't have packs with all their rations and bedrolls and all that sort of thing. So when they exited our aircraft on a combat assault, they weren't weighted down with a 50 or 60 pound pack. They were able to maneuver and so forth. What would happen then is after the assault was completed and the infantry unit was on the ground, that logistics helicopter that we were talking about earlier would bring them their packs that they were going to use while they were in the field. My understanding is that many of the assault helicopter companies that operated elsewhere in the country, when they made an assault, the infantry would have their backpacks with them. Sometimes they were able to carry only six instead of seven, I think largely because they had packs also.
Okay.
Now, the difference to that, of course, the Long Range Reconnaissance Patrols, when we dropped them off in the field, they had all their gear with them, so they would go out there with their packs and so forth.
Did you take any gear with you, like, for the crew? Was there anything, was there any, like, gear that was for the crew?
We wore a chest protector that everybody called a chicken plate. It weighed about 20 pounds and would stop a rifle bullet. We also had, the pilots all had revolvers. You could carry extra gear along for yourself. You would bring your maps and so forth. The pilots were really quite a bit better protected than the crew chief and the gunner from ground fire, because in addition to having the chest protector, we sat in an armored seat. And that armored seat was made out of, I believe, the same material the chest protectors were made out, but it would stop a 30 caliber bullet, would not even slow down appreciably a 50 caliber bullet, go right through all that. But the pilots were pretty well protected from ground fire. The crew chief and the gunner had a chicken plate, and they often took another one and sat on it for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And actually, it's kind of interesting. If you look at the statistics for the Vietnam War, you're going to find that there were more non-pilot crew members killed in the war than pilots. And some people will attribute that to the fact that the pilots in a Huey were in an armored seat. I think it's much more associated with the fact that the pilots had had an excellent restraint system. We had a wide, full-race aircraft seatbelt and an inertial shoulder harness. So if we crashed, we stayed in the seat, essentially, whereas the crew chief and the gunner, sometimes they didn't even wear a seatbelt. But if they did, all they had was a 1.5-inch wide kind of regular seatbelt. So I think most of the reason the non-pilot crew members suffered higher casualties and more associated with being injured in crashes than anything else.
Was it? Did it feel exposed though when you were sat in the pilot's seats?
Well, of course, when you're sitting in a Huey, or any helicopter for that matter, you have excellent visibility. So what's essentially between you and the outside in the cockpit area is plexiglass, or the aluminum of the door on the side, but the aluminum of on the side of the aircraft was very thin. I mean, a 22 caliber bullet would go right through it without any problem. So I guess from the standpoint of being exposed, you were. I can't remember ever being concerned about that, though. I mean, it was just kind of the way it was.
Yeah, just a fact.
Right.
So it's basically just like a glass sort of bubble that you sort of sat in.
Well, we have a Huey helicopter hanging from the ceiling in the Veterans Museum, but you had a plexiglass windshield and a solid nose on the aircraft, and then also at the bottom front of the aircraft there were chin bubbles that were plexiglass, because when you were making an approach in a helicopter, it was usually fairly steep as compared to a fixed-wing aircraft landing. And in the approach, and certainly at the bottom of the approach, you'd be looking at the ground through the chin bubble rather than the plexiglass windshield. And we also had plexiglass right over our heads that we could look straight up through the top of the aircraft.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much satisfied my needs, Rick. So, thank you for that.
Oh, you're very welcome. I hope that works for you.